Good morning. I'm speaking with Juan Ricardo Cole, the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan and specialist in Islamic, Arabic, Middle Eastern, and North African studies. He's the author of over a dozen books, including his most recent, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires, and other books, including The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East and Engaging the Muslim World. Cole is a public intellectual, prominent blogger, and prolific essayist. You can find much of his work on the important website Informed Comment. Welcome back to KABU, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Laura.
In 2014, we had you on the show to talk about Israel's 7-week bombardment of Gaza. Less than a decade later, no one could anticipate the horrific live stream genocide and massive destruction of the past year. But when I say no one could anticipate, do you think Netanyahu was waiting for an October 7th opportunity to advance a plan to destroy Gaza and accelerate displacement and departure of Palestinians?
I think that Benjamin Netanyahu is a pragmatist. If he needs to make an alliance with the Labour Party, he does. He's had them in his cabinets. In order to get back into power in 2022, he had to make an alliance with the Israeli equivalent of the Proud Boys. The extremist far-right racist fascist elements, which had been a red line for Israeli politics, but Netanyahu brought them in. He made Itamar Ben-Gvir the Minister of National Security, and made Bezalel Smotrich Minister of Finance, but gave him a portfolio of responsibility for the civil administration of the Palestinian West Bank. Both are settlers themselves. They're squatters on Palestinian land beyond the borders of Israel. So I think that, Netanyahu is an opportunist. Where he thinks he could get away with something, he would do it. He does belong to the far right Likud party, which is not quite as far right, but really far right compared to anything else as the as the religious Zionists and the Jewish power blocs. And he, back in the Trump administration, he at one point wanted to annex formally part of the Palestinian West Bank and said that, Trump is in and we have an opportunity to do this. It never went through, but he has his eye out for these opportunities to liquidate the Palestinians, to grab more of their land, to crowd them out. And I think, it's not that there's a master plan, but that where an opportunity arises that one could where the Israelis could diminish the Palestinian presence, could grab more land from them, could crowd them out possibly entirely. They would go for it.
Now that Israel has completely destroyed Gaza, it has turned to Lebanon, ostensibly to crush Hezbollah. Biden and Blinken continue to claim Israel has a right to defend itself as they offer faint appeals for humanitarian considerations. What does Israel have to gain from this assault on Lebanon, given its past history in attacking Lebanon? Does it seriously believe it can remake the Middle East?
Yes, I think that Netanyahu believes this is a moment where he has complete backing from the United States and where he can reshape the Israeli security environment. From Israel's point of view, their security situation is not ideal. Although they got a separate peace with Egypt, which was the biggest and most threatening of the Arab armies, and a peace deal with Jordan. They still have hostile relations with Syria. And they have hostile relations with southern Lebanon in the form of Hezbollah and also of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon who were expelled by the Israelis in 1948 and who have a long history of going across the border and attacking Israel, either with guerrilla actions or with rockets. At the moment, tens of thousands of Israeli residents of northern Israel have been forced from their homes, and this is true from the beginning of the Gaza War when Hezbollah took Hamas's side and began increasing its rocket fire at Israel in support of Hamas. This is just unacceptable to the Israeli government. They want freedom of action. If they feel they need to go into Gaza, they want to be able to go into it without being harassed from the rear by Hezbollah from Lebanon. And so they are taking this opportunity to attempt to severely attrite Hezbollah's capabilities. I think ultimately a diplomatic deal could be done of the sort that was done in 2006, where a cold peace could be arranged, where the Hezbollah would agree not to fire its rockets into Israel and would move away from the Israeli-Lebanese border. That, of course, would please Netanyahu if Netanyahu could get another buffer zone inside Lebanon, occupy part of Lebanon, as the Israelis did from 1982 to 2000. That would please Netanyahu if they could find a way to occupy enough Lebanese territory so that they would get access to Lebanese rivers and could siphon the water off towards Israel. That would please Netanyahu as well. So there could be several goals in this campaign, but one of them would be to neutralize Hezbollah as a security factor for Israel, at least in the medium term.
And do you think that's likely to happen?
I'm not very good at predicting the future. I think it's certainly possible that a 2006 style diplomatic resolution of this particular war on the Lebanese front could happen. You should remember that Lebanon is a multicultural society, has a substantial number of Christians, of Sunni Arabs, and the Shiites in the south are not all Hezbollah supporters. Hezbollah is a primarily Shiite party, but it has a rival in the form of Amal, and usually splits seats in parliament with Amal. So the other forces in Lebanon are not happy about being dragged into a war with Israel, especially since Israel is targeting facilities, buildings, even civilians beyond the Shiites, beyond the Hezbollah, what the press calls the Hezbollah strongholds, which is a huge misnomer because you can't assume that a Shiite neighborhood is necessarily a pro-Hezbollah. And even if it were, it's not a warrant to wipe out the civilians who live there. But in any case, these other forces in Lebanon will be putting pressure on Hezbollah to cool it. And we'll be reaching out to the United States and Europe, perhaps to the Gulf, to try to find a way of negotiating an end to this round of fighting.
You've pointed out in a column in Common Dreams that U.S. efforts in the region have been undermined by its breathtaking hypocrisy, and that the Biden administration is wearing the same blinkers that once blinded LBJ and his advisors as they accelerated the Vietnam War. So how is the United States becoming drawn into this larger conflict?
Well, President Biden's main foreign policy initiative up until October 7th of last year had been to organize Europe to resist the Russian occupation of part of Ukraine on the grounds that the Russia's invasion of Ukraine and occupation of the Donbas and other regions contravened the United Nations Charter, which forbids acquisition of territory by military means, and under the Geneva Convention of 1949, which governs how populations in occupied territories are treated during a war, and Russia was violating the Geneva Convention's provisions, and. These provisions have been incorporated into the Rome Statute, which is the charter for the International Criminal Court, a body of international humanitarian law that the court has jurisdiction over and has been signed on to by 124 of the world's countries. And the U.S. actually, although it always refused to sign the Rome Statute, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, I think very cynically appealed to the International Criminal Court to indict Vladimir Putin for war crimes, and it actually did so. The ICC delivered a warrant against Putin in the spring of 2023. Which Blinken and the Biden administration hailed as a wonderful development. But of course, Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories that it seized in 1967 is illegal. It has been declared illegal by the International Court of Justice, which is the United Nations court that adjudicates issues among UN member states. And so Israel is guilty not only of an illegal occupation, just as Russia is in the Ukraine, but also of committing gross violations of the laws governing occupied territories, and of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza and in the Palestinian West Bank. To be consistent, the U.S. would have to condemn Netanyahu as forcefully as it condemned Vladimir Putin. It has not. It has made excuses for Netanyahu. It has skated around the edges of the law. It has buried internal State Department documents that found that Israel is violating U.S. law and ought not to receive further weaponry. And it has defended Israel repeatedly in the course of these atrocities. So, from the point of view of the rest of the world, when Biden comes to India or to Latin America or to Africa, and says, we want you to boycott Putin. We want you to boycott the Russian economy because of their occupation policies in Ukraine. People fall down laughing and they decline to sign on. Almost nobody outside of the NATO countries has signed on to the Russian boycott, and therefore it has failed to crash the Russian economy as the US had hoped. Even Israel has not signed on to it, but virtually no U.S. partners outside of NATO have joined this effort. And one of the reasons is that it's very difficult for the rest of the world to take the U.S. stance on Ukraine and Palestine seriously. They clearly see the vast contradiction and the hypocrisy. And so I think it has undermined Biden's Ukraine effort.
I would think, especially in the Middle East, undermining any support for the United States. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mill Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm speaking with Professor Juan Cole about Israel's war on Gaza and Lebanon. Professor Cole, let's talk about American resistance to U.S. policies. Over the past year, we've seen hundreds of protests across the country, especially on college campuses. Students, including many Jewish students, have been leading protests and divestment efforts. But university administrators have tried to shut these down with a ferocity that we've not seen with other protest movements. What drives this determination to shut down protest and speech about Gaza?
Well, I think university administrators see what's going on in the Middle East through a very particular lens, and their discourse would be very similar to that of the Biden administration that characterizes what's going on as Israel's right to defend itself. The students see very clearly, in a way that their elders often do not. That these are war crimes that are being committed, crimes against humanity. Perhaps it's being adjudicated, but perhaps genocide. And are outraged that the university administrators, who again, all the universities in the United States boycotted Russia. They divested from Russian firms. Their presidents denounced Vladimir Putin in no uncertain terms. So the students say, well, you did that with regard to Russia. Why won't you do it with regard to Netanyahu? The administrators don't really have a good answer for that. And in fact, now at my university and others, the administrations are adopting a neutrality policy to get them out of having to say anything about world affairs. But this is precisely in order not to have to say anything about what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. I think that these student protests against what Israel is doing in Palestine are multivalent. They threaten lots of different potential interests. They threaten the U.S. establishment, which is, views Israel as a kind of a bulwark for U.S. security in the Middle East, as a kind of aircraft carrier for American operations in the Middle East, and which very much wants to preserve that functionality, and so doesn't want to damage Israel by divesting. I think there's a latent white nationalism in the United States, which became clear with the rise of Trumpism, and from which the Democratic Party is not immune either. And I think that in contemporary United States, the Israelis are coded as the whites and as facing barbarian hordes. So there's a knee-jerk support of them, which translates into the views of some of the white suburbanites about Detroit and Michigan. There's a substantial Jewish community in the United States and in universities who many of whom were brought up to identify with Israel. About two-thirds or four-fifths of Jewish Americans say that they're emotionally invested in Israel. And I've seen them, students actually have tears in their eyes at seeing Israel criticized. And I think for some Jewish Americans that Israel is a vehicle for ego inflation, that their whole identity is wrought up with it. And it becomes a sacred cow. It becomes sacrosanct. There's a question is, can you criticize Israel? There isn't such a question about any other country in the world. I mean, we have millions of Mexican Americans in the United States. Nobody ever, brings up the question of whether it's all right to criticize Mexico. Does that make you anti-Latino? And then there is this, I think, deeply dishonest and completely illegitimate attempt to identify criticism of Israeli policy with internal domestic anti-Semitism, which are very different phenomena. Anti-Semitism is a plague. It's a scourge on society, and it should be denounced and fought against everywhere it rears its ugly head. But protesting what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza has nothing to do with Judaism, and I think the same protests would be there and have been there in other instances of governments acting in unlawful ways against defenseless populations.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Juan Cole. Listeners can find Juan Cole's recent work many places, especially Informed Comment, Common Dreams, The Nation, Salon.com, and Foreign Policy in Focus. Thanks again.
Thank you, Lori.